Okay. Good afternoon. Let's call to order the House Committee on Land Use for Thursday, January 29th, 2009. We will open an informational meeting. Two things, colleagues and members of the public. Just a reminder to members of the public who are here with us in the room and who might be watching the proceedings on video, you will see some of the members of the committee referring to laptop computers. I want to assure you that this is part of a green initiative that the legislature is undertaking, and these members are trying to go paperless, and they are tracking the bills that we have and the information we have on computers instead of those of us who are still a little old tech and using paper. So don't be surprised if you see that.
How would that
transition?
And colleagues, I will probably make that announcement a few more times over the session, just as new members of the audience, so that people don't think anyone's up here playing computer games while we're listening to testimony. It's our attempt to be green.
Some of us are failing.
We have several, in fact, we have four panels that we will hear from today, members of the committee. We'll start off with presentations from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Director, Mr. Whitman, and from the Commission, the LCDC, John Landingham, the Chair of that commission. Then we will go to a panel of people representing users of the land use system and the built environment on the land use system, specifically realtors and home builders. Then we will go to a panel that represents users of the of our land use system in the natural resources area, forestry, farming, nurseries, and vineyards. And finally, we will hear from a panel of people representing groups who are watchdogs of land use, and that is Oregonians in Action and 1,000 Friends of Oregon. So that's the program for this afternoon, and let's get started. Excuse me, Mr. Hoyt, can you tone this down a little bit? It's reverbing. Yeah. Mr. Whitman.
Thank you, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I have two purposes in the presentation that I'm going to give today. The primary purpose is to give you a brief overview from sort of the staff perspective of the recommendations of the Big Look Task Force to help frame the discussion for the other panels that you're going to be hearing from today. I am going to then just give you a few comments on sort of big picture look from the department perspective on this. Obviously, the department comes at this from several different angles. We've been staffed to the Big Look Task Force under the bill, Senate Bill 82, that created this process. But we're also administering the statewide land use planning program, so we've tried to keep those roles very clear and separate as we've worked on this process, and I'll speak to you from those two perspectives today. So if I could, on the PowerPoint presentation, get that up there. Okay. All right. First of all, Senate Bill 82, you all know, you've heard this already, created the Big Look Task Force back in 2005, 10 members from around the state.
Thank you.
In different, coming from different perspectives, really a broad array of, a broad array of experience with the land use planning program. From a number of different places. There were three main charges to the task force, to evaluate the effectiveness of our land use planning program, to think about the respective roles and responsibilities of state and local government, and to look at land use issues both in terms of urban growth boundaries and in terms of management of lands in rural areas. This is an overview of the recommendations contained in the Big Look Task Force report. There are 7 primary legislative recommendations and 4 non-legislative recommendations. I'm going to frame those a little bit in terms of big issues that I think themes that come out of the task force report. They are how do we deal with some of the variation around our state in terms of differing conditions? How do we deal with some of the at least perceived rigidity and flexibility in the system? Large degree, the significant degree of complexity in our system. How do we allow it to adapt over time? And then a particular issue in terms of management of land use in urban areas. How do we deal with the connection between our land use system and our public finance system, particularly as they come together over infrastructure finance? So in terms of the legislative recommendations, the first one is that we have a vision statement, if you will, of what our land use planning program should be trying to achieve. We have 19 statewide planning goals. They don't really describe exactly where we're trying to go as a state. And the task force felt that it was important that there be a clear articulation from the legislature of what we should be, where we should be trying to get to with our land use planning program. These principles, as Chair Thorne testified to earlier this week, do not replace the statewide planning goals. They are principles that would have to be considered by bodies that adopt new land use law in the future or by courts when they interpret existing land use law. And I use that word consider very pointedly because this was designed carefully so that it would not generate a large amount of additional litigation. That's one concern that's been expressed. The second area in terms of legislative recommendations has to do with how do we encourage regional approaches to land use planning. There are 3 sub-elements here. The first is how do we improve an existing tool that we have on the books called regional problem solving that has been used in a couple of parts of the state. We've had one instance where it was not successful, another instance underway right now where we hope it will be successful. But there have been some problems with those statutes, and so there are some recommendations to try to give more incentives to local governments to work together to solve land use problems. The second element here gets to the relationship between our land use planning program and our governance system in terms of counties versus cities versus special districts. We have areas of the state that have been urbanized that are not within cities, and that can create a disjunct between our land use planning system and our governance systems. So this is not intended to go back and change decisions with regard to areas that have already been added to urban growth boundaries, but saying going forward, on a going forward basis, if we're going to add lands to our urban growth boundaries, generally those areas should eventually be included within cities once they urbanize.
Madam Chair, how do you want to handle questions?
I'd like to wait until the panel's completed their presentation.
The third element of this has to do with something I've already mentioned, the infrastructure finance piece, and that is a direction to the Department of Transportation and other state sources of finance to include, those programs all have criteria for how dollars get spent already and procedures that are set up. The recommendation from the task force is that in addition to those criteria that are already out there, that those bodies that are allocating those funds should also consider allocation of those funds to support development patterns that are efficient. The third area of legislative recommendations is the one that has probably gotten the most attention so far. This is the one that's focused on rural areas of our state and management of rural lands. This is the most complex area in terms of recommendations coming from the task force. Again, there's an element of trying to incent regional approaches. Mike Thorne talked about some of this in his presentation on Tuesday, but I'm going to run you back through it in a little bit more detail. This process would have several steps. Its overall intent is to deal with the situations in rural parts of the state where land has been zoned for farm or forest use, and the property owners of that land believe that it is not economically viable to carry out those uses. And also deal with the question of, if it's not going to be farm or forest uses on those lands, then what is the use going to be? What will work within our state system in terms of what uses are sustainable over time? So the first element of this is a political check and balance. It's an opt-in. This is not a mandate from the state, but it would allow two or more counties to petition to create a regional definition of what lands are farm and forest lands within that part of the state. They would propose an area, and they would propose criteria for what lands should be managed for those purposes. They would make that proposal to the Land Conservation and Development Commission. There are sideboards in the statute that provide some overall guidance for those criteria, but also provide for flexibility. The main direction is, rather than basing those definitions just on soil type, which has been one of the primary criteria in the past, that this would look more functionally at what lands are important for the agricultural industry and the forest industry now and in the future. So, again, that petition would be made to LCDC. LCDC would have to approve two things. One, what's the area that these criteria are going to apply within? What makes sense in terms of a region for agricultural practices or forest practices? And then it would actually have to approve the criteria as well. Once that was done, and it probably would be done for more than two counties. We're probably I think the concept is this would be five or six regions within the state. Then the counties within those regions could apply those criteria and go into a reexamination of what lands are designated as farm and forest lands. They would have to do that on a legislative basis. They could not do it on a property by property basis. They'd have to look at the whole of the county at a time. Two other critical elements or conditions of that relook at rural lands. If a county opts to do that, they would also have to re-examine their programs for protecting significant natural areas and resources and update their inventories of what resources are significant and update their programs for protecting those resources. The second major condition is that they would also have to go through an examination of what uses would be allowed on the other rural lands, the lands that are not farm or forest. And this is a look at what's the carrying capacity of those lands. Are we going to have five-acre ranchettes across the landscape on those lands, or is it something else? So the counties would have to go through a process of analyzing what the carrying capacity of those lands are, looking at water, transportation, effect on agriculture and forestry, a range of things, before they could go through the rezone process. Also, LCDC would adopt rules that would define that exercise more carefully. So that's the rural lands piece. And then the fourth element is getting at the overall issue of complexity in our land use system. And I think one thing the task force heard as it went around the state was frustration with how complex our system is. The inability of the average citizen to know how to participate in our land use system and some of the barriers to participation in our land use system. So the task force has a series of recommendations on reducing complexity that essentially come down to a first stage technical review of statutes, goals, and rules to eliminate complexity. And then a second stage policy review to make sure that this is done on a policy neutral basis that would then result in a series of recommendations to the legislature for changes to the program. Fifth area of legislative recommendations has to do with strategic planning. And this has two main elements. The first is for something that we've never really had in the state, and that is a state-level strategic plan for where are we trying to go with our transportation, economic development, land use, water systems at a state level, not getting down into the details of where we're trying to go in particular communities, but broad brush, where are we trying to go as a state. The second element is we have, as I mentioned, 19 statewide planning goals in our system already. We have performance measures for DLCD, but we haven't really done a good job, frankly, of tying the statewide planning goals to performance measures. And again, this gets to trying to have a system where it's clear to the public what are we trying to achieve with our planning program. So performance measures that describe what is it that we're trying to do with our planning system, and then a system for measuring how we're doing at both the state level and local level over time. Okay, now moving into the non-legislative recommendation, citizen participation, that is goal one of the statewide land use planning program, is citizen participation. This has been a critical element of the program from the onset. There's a lot of frustration out there with citizen participation on all sides over a variety of issues. So basically, this is direction to the agency, to DLCD, to do more work with local governments to improve citizen participation, particularly with regard to land use actions on specific land use actions. That's where a lot of the frustration in the system is now. But then also to assist local governments in citizen participation on broader planning efforts as well. Infrastructure finance. In particular, the task force heard from local government loud and clear that we've got a mismatch between our land use system and our public finance infrastructure system at this point. You saw the article in the Oregonian last weekend about Damascus. There have been similar articles about the fact that areas that are being added to our urban growth boundaries, and this is not just Damascus, it's also Bethany, it's also other areas of the state, even if they are flat and level, cannot get services because of the expense of providing those services and the fact that local sources of finance to pay for those services have been severely curtailed over the last 10 years by the state, and the federal sources of funding for those services have increasingly diminished over time. So basically, direction to the state to avoid further preemption of local options, to review the preemptions that are out there, and again, come back to the legislature with recommendations for the future on how to better align our finance system with our land use system. I'll note here, there are also some recommendations coming out of the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, headed by Lane Shetterly, that mirror some of the recommendations being given by the Big Look Task Force. Climate change. The Big Look Task Force heard a lot of testimony, particularly toward the end of their process, from organizations that are concerned about the effects of climate change on our state, the need for our state to plan to adapt to those effects, and also the need for the planning program to play a part in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. We have specific recommendations that have been made to LCDC by the State Global Warming Commission, and the task force is urging that the commission and the department consider those recommendations carefully. In terms of economic development, the task force identified a number of things that the agency can do without statutory changes to work with local governments as partners to improve the planning process, to assure that we do have lands that are needed for industrial and commercial development. Those include the maintenance over time of the Certified Industrial Site Program. They also include perhaps building some efficiencies into how we amend urban growth boundaries to encourage economic development. Okay. So those are the, that's the overview of the recommendations coming from the task force. I think in terms of the department's perspective on that, we believe that the recommendations of the task force have hit on a number of important areas and we're supportive of the task force recommendations. I think we recognize that even with the history of the planning program in terms of Measure 7, Measure 37, Measure 49, there's still an awful lot of friction out there in the system that needs to be dealt with in terms of putting the planning program on a solid long-term footing. And we think that the overall thrust of the Big Look Task Force recommendations addresses a number of those. We also believe that in terms of challenges for the program going forward, that climate change really is a significant challenge for our state, both in terms of adaptation and mitigation that needs attention by the land use program. And finally, we'd echo the focus on public finance and infrastructure. That's a challenge that we're trying to work through with Portland Metro right now in another setting that was set in motion under Senate Bill 1011 in the last session for urban and rural reserve planning. Hopefully that'll give us some answers with regard to that issue. So that concludes my testimony, Madam Chair.
Great. Mr. Van Landingham.
Thank you, Chair Nolan. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Eugene, Verlaine County, and I serve as the Commission's chair. I want to tell you a little bit about Land Conservation and Development Commission. We have a number of responsibilities. One is to make the rules that enforce the program, including the goals and interpreting the goals. We also review comprehensive plan updates. We hear some appeals, not all land use appeals, and significant to the person on my left, we hire and fire the director of the department. I believe when the program was set up in the 70s, the legislature did that, and we're one of the few commissions that does have that power as opposed to the governor. I think the legislature then thought that was a way to keep some of the politics out of this issue. There are seven members of the commission. We have regional representation by statute. We are required to have a county person who's been a county commissioner or is a county commissioner, a person who is or was a city councilor, and informally, the governor has tried to appoint someone who has a farm background. Members are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. The seven members are as follows. So there's me. I've been on the commission for 9 years. I've told you what I do for a real job. I served on the Eugene Planning Commission for about 12 years. I've been on the LCDC for 9 years. I've been chair for 5 years. The vice chair is Margaret Kirkpatrick, who is a lawyer in Portland, in-house counsel for Northwest Natural Gas. She would like to retire from the commission due to her other commitments, and the governor has appointed Greg McPherson, your former colleague, to replace her. He has not yet been considered by the Senate. Merlin Warricks from McMinnville, the former state rep, former city councilor in McMinnville, retired realtor, also an artist. Tim Josie, another former state rep, who is a current Tillamook County commissioner. And I think just leaving his position as chair of the Association of Oregon Counties. Dennis Derby, Clackamas home builder. Hanley Jenkins, a longtime planning director in Union County and LeGrand. And then our newest member, Christine Pellet, is a commercial property appraiser and a large rose grower in Jackson County. I want to say a few things about the Big Look recommendations. The Commission, in general, supports the report. The Commission was a supporter of the creation of the Big Look Task Force. We strongly feel the program needs some improvements. We've shared our thoughts with the task force and with the director. We had a meeting. Our last face-to-face meeting was in Prineville, I think, in October. And I think that the task force and the director are trying to address the concerns that we've raised. So I'll only hit on some things that I want to emphasize and hope that we might be able to help you as you go forward. With regard to the guiding principles, as Richard noted, we're concerned that we not add another appeal criteria, which would increase the complexity of an already complex program. One of our members has asked why the principles don't include preservation of farm and forest land and whether this signals some sort of shift in the emphasis of the program. Regarding regional planning, we are big proponents at the Commission level of regional planning. The statute makes it difficult to implement, so it needs to be cleaned up. But we also need to find an effective incentive for local governments. One of the failed efforts at regional planning came in my community, Eugene and Springfield, when Springfield essentially said, what's in it for us? What's the benefit of staying in and doing all this work? What do we get out of this? Regarding the remapping of farm and forest land, we agree that there are mapping mistakes and errors. We agree that it would be a good idea to find a way to fix those. We're concerned that this approach may well be complicated, time-consuming, and expensive for both the state and the counties. I've spent 9 years on the commission, as I said. My work interest is affordable housing and landlord-tenant law. I would like to do some urban issues in my remaining 2 years on the commission. It seems to me the program has really focused on rural land issues a lot in its first 35 years. Regarding reducing complexity, that's incredibly important. It's something that we've been working on ourselves, although we don't have a lot of capacity to do that, but we are doing it. An example is making it clearer on how urban growth boundary expansions occur, trying to provide some safe harbors for doing that. One big problem is overlapping statutes with rules, so it's hard to change statutes. We don't have the power to change statutes. It'd be good if we could work from one set of criteria. I want to caution you, though, that I think this a natural inclination in this area is to pick people who are not, quote, the usual suspects, as John Chandler likes to call them, the people who aren't already in the game. The risk there, and I think it's a serious risk, is that they don't know the ins and outs of the program. If we're going to do this, I think we need to have people who know what they're talking about to figure out creative ways to do this better. Let me also note that there are other issues that the Commission would like to work on besides these, because we're not operating in just a world of the Big Look. These are some things that the Commission has talked about trying to do, trying to find the capacity to do that. They include Goal 10, before I leave, trying to figure out what it exactly means. We talk within Goal 10 about land supply. Land supply does not mean that the land is affordable for affordable housing development. We do some significant things there. Excuse me. That's the housing goal of the 19 goals. Thank you. We do some significant things with that. We require local governments to allow, for example, manufactured housing parks. A city cannot zone out mobile home parks. We also require cities to have a supply of land for multifamily housing. I heard an expert recently talk about Atlanta, the Atlanta area where most cities don't allow multifamily housing. That's a significant thing. But we really don't do much more than that, to my way of thinking. The Commission would also like to continue working on simplifying efforts. We'd like to work, as Richard talked about, on global warming and sea level rise and sustainability. Earlier today, Richard and I and some of the staff people met with the representatives of the Environmental Justice Task Force, which you all created last session. They would like to find a way to implement their concerns in the land use program. We are interested in improving citizen involvement. We're interested in the resumption of periodic review. All local governments, cities and counties, were required to do comprehensive plans when the program was adopted in 1973. By the early 80s, they had done that. At that point, the legislature went, oh, we need a way to update these plans, so created periodic review. Periodic review had some serious problems. You all adopted a moratorium on it. We've sort of redone that through a task force that I chaired a couple years ago. We don't require everybody to do it. We're trying to make it more streamlined, but we're now resuming it. So now we're having cities like Roseburg initiate periodic review to update their plans. And we need to be able to have the capacity, the time, at the staff level and at the commission level to work with them to do that. And I would be politically dumb not to mention that we're also interested in destination resorts. And I believe there's a bill asking you all to direct us to work on destination resorts. I welcome this opportunity to talk to you. We offer our assistance as you go forward. We care deeply about the land use program, and we want to make it better, and we appreciate that you do too. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to mention just one more thing.
Yes, please.
We also have a very important task that we have been charged with completing, and that is implementation of Measure 49. I don't want that to be lost, and that, I think, in our minds from the department, really still is job one, getting that completed, in addition to starting to look forward to things after that. So.
Great. Good point. Members of the committee, we have a bit of time to delve down a little deeper with these two witnesses. Any questions? Representative Greenwick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Whitman, I'm intrigued with your four principles, and then I see this issue about annexation and requiring requiring lands added to the UGB to be a part of a city. About half my district represents land in the UGB that's not in the city, and there are lots of quality level services for them. But I was wondering how that piece relates to the four principles that you, I mean, I would assume most of your recommendations would follow from one of the principles and the four principles.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, a clarification on the annexation proposal. It is not intended, nor is it written, to prevent districts from continuing to provide services, be the service providers for urban areas. It is intended to put cities in charge of the overall governance of those areas and the land use decisions in those areas. And I think this is in part coming out of experience recently where areas have been added to the urban growth boundary, and then there have been decisions and they're ready to urbanize. And decisions on whether to annex those lands have then come before the voters and been turned down. And as a result of that, we've not had the tools in place to actually allow those areas to urbanize. So that's where the disconnect comes in. I think some of the details that we've been working on the bill, actually we have some technical amendments that we're working on to the bill, and one of those recognizes that in areas of the state where we already have a large amount of land that has been urbanized, is not within a city, that first of all, we're not trying to change that, and second of all, we may need to provide exemptions. So Not every case would annexation be required. So, for instance, to take Washington County as an example, where you've got a large amount of unincorporated land, there may not be a city close by where it makes sense to annex into. So we are working on some amendments to the bill that would reflect that that sort of situation and provide a relief valve for that. And then in terms of how it gets back to the principles and how the annexation piece relates to that, I think particularly with regard to prosperous economy, again, we're seeing situations where our planning system is breaking down because of a disconnect between the planning system and our annexation laws, and somehow we need to get those things back into alignment.
May I follow briefly, Matt?
Yes, Representative.
I know we passed a statute years ago or something that said urban services should be provided by cities, and that may even have made sense at that time. But one of the things about the Big Look was to look back over old decisions. And the issue to me is that annexation is a governance issue. And we have some principles around that people ought to be able to choose how they're governed. So I guess what I'm asking you is should the land use decisions dictate governance matters, or are they almost independent questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the point...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think the point of the recommendation is not that one should govern over the other, but somehow we need to get them in alignment so that we don't have them going in different directions. I don't have any personal opinion about which one should govern, if either, but I think we do need to, I would agree that we somehow need to get them in better alignment than they are currently.
If I might offer a land use perspective, I think that one of the great difficulties with voting on annexations is that communities plan for certain levels of density in the land they add. And in some cases, I don't know if that's true of all, the level of density that the opponent's annexation will approve is less than that. And so the community might have planned to provide infrastructure for this higher level of density. It doesn't happen as a result of the opposition to the annexation. It's hard to see, in some cases, how the comprehensive plan process fits in with voting on annexations. That's what I think they're getting at, the coordination issue of it.
Further questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, I appreciate the additional comment about your concerns about the not losing sight of the implementation process of Measure 49. And, Madam Chair, I hope that at some point in this committee's deliberation we'll be able to come back to this a bit. But I was just wondering if you could very briefly sort of elaborate on the priority setting, decision making sort of work that you're doing and what needs to be done in that line.
So, Madam Chair,
please understand, Representative Cowan and members of the committee, that we will indeed spend time on that at some length during the course of
the
session.
Great, thank you. And yes. So we can go very brief, keep this very brief at this point.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, we have about 4,000 claims that we are dealing with under Measure 49, and we have completed preliminary reviews of about 600 of those. The rate at which we are processing has continued to increase. We have recently done a recalculation of how long we expect it to take to get through this work. And we are looking at somewhere between April and December of 2010 at this point for completing that work. The work is complicated. It involves dealing with chain of title, property issues, tract issues, historical zoning issues. We have taken a number of administrative steps to streamline the work, which was part of the reason that there was a bit of a delay before we got going. Those steps are now in place, and so as I said, I think we're now moving forward at a better clip.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Cowan?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Flynn?
I'll hold them till later.
Sure.
We will have plenty of time to talk about that. There's a lot of interest among members of the committee.
Thank you.
So I have three. If you just want me to do one for starters.
What? That's a good way to start?
All right. I'm not going to comment on my views on annexation. We'll talk about that later. So the non-resource lands, the concept about two counties nominating a new definition of agricultural land, then if you're not in that definition, you would then be in what most people would consider now a non-resource land. What is broken with the existing process of coming in and saying, my land is non-resource land and I've got the soils to prove it and a historical pattern to prove it, change my zone. I know it happens. I know people get it. What's broken about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, a great question. And the direct answer is there are as you know, the means under existing law to fix mapping errors. It can be done. It is, as Mike Thorne said on Tuesday, however, doing it on a property-by-property basis is expensive and very resource-intensive. I think this concept would do a couple of things. One, it would, I think, provide some incentive for a broader reexamination of those designations, in part by taking a functional look at what lands are important to the agricultural industry and the forest industry in a particular region of the state, and providing somewhat more flexibility than we have under current law to do that. The recommendation does require to start that there be two or more counties that start the process, and as Chair Thorne indicated, that was very intentional to try to assure that there was broad political support at the local level for undertaking this effort. So the task force was trying to balance a number of things. I guess the last thing I would say is what's broken in the system. I think it's the very clear perception being articulated by people particularly in central and eastern Oregon is that this continues to be a problem and that the existing system isn't addressing it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think what would be helpful for me at some point is to know how many of these conversions took place under the existing process, roughly what they pay in fees, and who I would like to see that someone was actually denied. I'd like to see some cases of people who were denied, that they said they had soil types that were bad and then it was denied, to understand why it is then that they're saying, boy, it's not working well. My county's saying, you know, I'm dead wrong, even though I feel I've got sagebrush and rocks only. I'd like, you know, just that would be helpful from an information standpoint.
Okay. Last question?
I could hold. I have two more, but I could hold and let some others ask.
Representative Hanna will provide a break in the
It's a very brief question. Director, and I asked the other day, I don't think we really got an answer to it. Were there two rural counties who came to the Big Look Task Force and said, we want to combine our efforts and do this together? Or was that part of the task force recommendation? I'm hearing from a number of rural county planners that nobody came together and said, here's a good idea. More to Representative Klim's point, they felt comfortable in having the option as individual counties.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, a couple of points. First of all, no, two or more counties did not come to the task force and make that proposal. It was the reverse of that. We had a number of counties tell the task force or express concerns to the task force that if it was left up to individual counties, that there would be significant political pressure on an individual county to do this, and that so there were concerns at the local level about that getting underway, even when there might not be broad support for that to occur. And in order to achieve efficiency, it was felt that it really should be done on a regional basis. So I hope that answers your question. But two or more counties have not come to the task force.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Anybody else? Representative Klim.
Oh, thank you. So did the task force talk at all about if you did this process of redefining agricultural lands in certain places, or for that matter, the existing process, you know, continued to work, then once you have a truer definition of agricultural land, did they talk at all about then really supporting that land by getting rid of some of the preposterous exemptions that are currently allowed in EFU land?
Madam Chair, Representative Klim, There was some testimony to the Big Look Task Force about conflicts on resource lands between non-resource uses and farm and forest uses. Not a lot, frankly, from rural parts of the state. So that has not been a major focus of the task force. I think the sense, just having participated in the hearings, was that we do have some tools under the existing program to deal with conflicts between non-resource uses and resource uses. And there wasn't an overwhelming message that on a broad scale that is broken. There was some testimony about again, it gets to the complexity and the rigidity, the large number of uses that are allowed. And so.
Last question.
Yes, follow up.
So, last session we had a bill about, I think it was hospices in farmland. And again, thinking it's peaceful, non-noisy, no pesticides that might be problematic. It was, I think, an unwise vision of what would be a good place for a hospice. Didn't move anywhere. But that was something that would be another addition to the EFU zone. So when I went through, and I went through this with some folks who actually know what they're doing, sort of line by line, you get to see a bill from me that sort of says what I think at least should come out of the EFU zone. I didn't see a one-size-fits-all system. Everywhere I looked, it said, in eastern Oregon, you can do that. Southern Oregon, you can do this. Can you please talk to me? I think you have a white paper on this topic of regional differences in our land use program. So I know your task force members heard it and they echoed it, but I would like to hear your opinion on whether it's really one-size-fits-all without any sort of diversity for our state.
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, we'd be happy to give you a copy of that paper from the department. I think, as you've indicated, there are provisions in both statute and goal and rule that do recognize regional differences in the state. I think from the task force perspective, again, they were hearing that there is still the perception out there that the program is not sufficiently responsive to regional differences.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Garrett, and then I think we'll move to the next panel.
Well, first, to follow up on that, maybe as a clarifying question, is the task force's recommendation about based on its conclusion that there is too much of a one-size-fits-all approach in the system, or is it based on trying to remedy a public perception, right or wrong, that there is a one-size-fits-all system?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrett, I think I hesitate to speak for the task force on that because I heard some of both from task force members. I think they're trying to address both of those issues. I think some of it is it's a political perception problem. And for at least some group of the task force, I think there's the sense that it's more than just a perception, but it's a on-the-ground reality.
Follow up?
On a different topic. It's more of a technical question. The petition process for the counties to come forward as right. Groups of two or more, is it intended that if two counties bring a petition, then the department must grant it and act on it? Because as I read the bill, it's unclear whether that's discretionary or not.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrett, there was a fair amount of discussion about this before the task force. It is intended to be discretionary on the part of the agency whether to accept a petition. And the reason, a large part of the reason for that was recognition of the possible cost and resources required to do some of this work. And so it was felt important to leave that discretion with the commission. At the same time, there was also a clear discussion that decision couldn't just be made arbitrarily, and that if the commission were to just summarily deny petitions, that there would quickly be a discussion before this body.
Very perceptive. I think we have at least exhausted our imagination for today.
All right.
Gentlemen, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Your
thank
time.
Thank you.
I'd like to call our next panel, which would include Sean Jillians, representing Oregon Association of Realtors, and John Chandler, representing the Oregon Home Builders Association. Mr. Jillians?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Excuse me while I get a PowerPoint up here, which is going to walk right into Representative Clem, I can see already from the previous questions. Madam Chair, as an association that comes together to represent people who represent buyers and sellers of homes, certainly land use is very important to our membership and the quality of life that we as Oregonians enjoy and expect plays a huge part in it. So what I hope to walk you through a little bit today was to talk a little bit about not only what our land use system has done right as far as preserving our quality of life, but also some of the trade-offs for that. As a native Oregonian who moved away to go to school and then came back to work and then moved away for work and came back, there's obviously something that draws us back here. And so we do appreciate that quality of life, but with that quality of life does come a few trade-offs. Specifically, I'm going to talk about housing prices and how land use regulations play into housing prices. This past year, there was a very interesting study produced by Dr. Theo Eicher from the University of Washington. As a loyal Duck, it's hard for me to endorse those Huskies, Mr. Chandler. But it took into account 250 cities from 1989 to 2006. And up there you'll see on the screen, one of the conclusions from the study was that I think probably not a lot of people surprised, statewide regulations and growth management do increase the cost of housing. One of the foundational studies that they used in this one also was the one that I've listed there, which was conducted by the Harvard Institute of Economic Research. Now, at the end of my handout, Madam Chair and committee members, I have the links for these studies. That was an effort to be green. They're rather lengthy. However, if anyone would like us to print those out, I'd happily do that for you and give them to you. I will warn you, as a communications major and law school attendee, I'm not very good at economics either, and they are rather dense and have a lot of formulas in them, but they are quite interesting reading.
Mr. Jillians, you're mindful of the length of our agenda.
Yes. Okay. Madam Chair, I promise you there's only 10 slides, and it'll get there quickly. As I mentioned before, the study by the University of Washington mentioned 250 cities. The time period is there. The regulatory data set, it's interesting to note on that real quickly, Madam Chair. The Wharton School of Business did that, and they surveyed 2,700 communities to talk about 70 different data points on land use regulations. So the conclusions there were these are the primary factors in the increased cost of housing. And Mr. Chandler, I'm sure, could attest to all of these. Permitting and approval delays are significant. Statewide land use regulations, court enforcement of statewide regulations, meaning being tied up in the courts, and growth management programs. They actually did a dollar figure for five cities in Washington. I picked four of them that were actually listed in there. And they came up with dollars for what the land use system in the state of Washington actually accounted for. Seattle actually was the highest, and Seattle actually is listed in the Wharton study as one of the highest regulated cities in the U.S. That was 203,000. Interesting to note, the Harvard study also came up with 201,000 on that. So that seems to be fairly accepted. Vancouver, our neighbors to the north, came in at $73,000. how does that actually impact Oregon? Well, when we look at the housing affordability in Oregon and the Home Builders Association, the National Home Builders Association does a housing opportunity index, we see that Oregon has four of the 30 least affordable metropolitan areas in the U.S. That's actually good news. As of a year ago, we had four of the 20 least affordable cities, but with the decline in the housing market, we've slipped down. You can see those ones, Bend, Medford, Eugene, Springfield, and the Portland area rounded out. If we go to the 70 least affordable cities in the entire U.S., we pull in Corvallis and Salem as well. So what did we recommend when we went before the Big Look Task Force, Representative Clem? We said one size does not fit all, and there need to be regional differences. You heard from the director the thought behind that. I would just say, to add to his excellent explanation, that just because there might be systems in place, they are expensive and time-consuming, and it shouldn't necessarily fall on landowners whose property has been miszoned to have to go through that extreme expense. Another issue that we brought forward to them was standing. We felt that there should be clear parameters for who could appeal a land use decision, and also, if possible, reduce the number of appeals allowed once a decision has been made. Identification of resource lands and accurate identification. Again, Representative Clem, this is primarily our Central Oregon and Eastern Oregon members are concerned with this, and talking about, you know, sagebrush and rocks and exactly the conversation that you had a minute ago. Economic development. The other half of that housing affordability index is median income. And so while our housing may seem affordable in relation to other Western states, our median incomes are not. And so as a trade association, we're quite concerned with economic development. You heard a little bit about the Certified Industrial Sites Program. We're happy that the Big Look talked about that and said it needed to be expanded upon. Any efforts to bring in additional employment bases to the state of Oregon, we'd certainly be supportive of. I pulled up the unemployment data this morning, actually, and saw that Oregon consistently ranks as one of the worst states. I'm certainly not saying this is a result of our land use system, but I'm saying if we could make tweaks in our land use system to make employment bases more accessible or bring in industry, we certainly should aim to do that. And it was interesting that 25 of the last 32 years, we've been above the national average in unemployment.
Thanks. Mr. Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler with the Oregon Home Builders Association. I would like to commend you on your delving into the theological thickets of Oregon land use. It has daunted many before you. Hopefully you will be undaunted and come out the other side this session with some changes. With regard to the bill itself, I want to make a couple preliminary comments, then talk about roughly what I've talked about. Some of you have heard me make this speech before. I think the purpose statement aspect of the bill is very good. I think it's about time we talked about what is important rather than what is the legal procedure that we have to go through. Our statewide goals right now are statewide purpose statements, they're statewide policy statements, but they're not necessarily statewide goals. With what this bill does, and we can discuss as we go forward, Madam Chair, what should be the targets, or these aren't them, a healthy environment, a prosperous economy, desirable quality of life, and fairness and equity. And I guess on the one hand, I think those are good because I'd like to see a show of hands for anybody that doesn't think those are good ideas. On the other hand, it does talk about some of the things that are critical to what have been perceived as defects in the planning program, a lack of fairness and balance, a lack of regard for healthy environment, a lack of regard for healthy economy. Those kind of goal statements, I think, and the task force hammered on these a long time. I'm not usually a big fan of goal statements and purpose statements. In this case, I think to refocus us on this journey through land use is important to say, why are we doing this? We've been at this, as you recall, for 30-some-odd years. And an awful lot of what we do in Oregon land use, we do because we do it. We've lost track of why we do it in a lot of cases. But it's on the books. It's in the rules. We've got court cases and lawyers and everybody else. So we continue getting back up to a little higher 30,000-foot level and get a better assessment of why we're having this contortion and why we have ORS 197 in the first place, I think is a good idea. The idea of regionalism. I think is a good idea. I'm not entirely thrilled with how the task force resolved that issue, but to answer some of the questions about one size fitting all and some of the other concerns that have come up in previous questions, I guess my thinking on it is, if one size doesn't fit all or does fit all isn't the point. The point is a big chunk of Oregon voters, of our citizenry, believe that that's the case, that the system has come from Salem and been distributed out to rural areas with a series of thou shalts. Letting the rural areas, the other parts of the state, actually have more of a voice in how they develop, whether they develop, where they develop, is going to do an awful lot to bleed some of the anger, some of the angst, and prevent more fistfights and actually get us focused back on what's important. The idea of a strategic plan. I was delighted to see this in Section 19, Section 20. I kind of lost track of the progress board, to tell you the honest truth. I could have sworn it got defunded a few sessions back. I was delighted to see it was still in business. That's a separate hearing, I understand, Representative. We don't have a strategic plan in this state. We don't have a business plan for Oregon. We don't know what our economy ought to look like, given where we sit on the Pacific Rim. And I've argued with this governor and previous governors, and I may well be wrong. I don't believe I am. I think we need a strategic plan for how we build Oregon's economy, how we protect what's important here, and how we do so in a comprehensive, holistic fashion. We've got pieces of it, and this bill calls for a synthesis of those pieces. I think that's delightful. Big quarrel I have with this bill, frankly, is the section on annexation, because I have no idea why they're getting in the middle of that fight. I would encourage you to help them not get in the middle of that fight. There are some unresolved issues. And this is my old speech, and I'll keep it short, Madam Chair, because I know you've certainly heard it before. We have focused for 30-some years in Oregon on what is arguably the least important part of Oregon's land use, and that is what happens in rural Oregon. I grew up there. I grew up farming. I'm not mad about farming. I used to be the state president of Oregon Future Farmers of America in a previous existence. I still have a blue jacket to prove it. But I would submit that if everybody in the state that wanted to go live on 5 acres out in the country did so tomorrow morning, we probably wouldn't notice. The big issues facing Oregon are urban. We don't know, even after 30 years of land use planning and 4 years of task force work, and goodness knows how many hearings in this body, we still don't know how to build a quality community in this state. We don't know how to pay for a quality community in this state. We have refused repeatedly to recognize the costs of our system. And I'm not saying they're good or bad. We haven't even been able to say, yep, there is one, but it's worth it. We've stymied someplace back on pretending there isn't one. It is easier in Oregon, after the aforementioned 30-some years of land use planning, it is still easier for my members to build single-family detached houses on a big lot than it is for us to build density, even a duplex. Our defaults haven't changed much since the 1970s. Our rhetoric has, our legal procedures have, but the actual outcome on the ground has not, and that is because we have been high-centered in a myopic fashion on rural lands issues. And I get fairly grumpy about this because, frankly, that's, again, with all due respect to rural Oregon, that's not where the majority of Oregonians live. That's not where the majority of Oregon jobs are. That's not where the majority of Oregon's problems are with regard to finance and other things. Yet that's where this program has focused. I think we need to talk more about how to resolve conflicts in a way that doesn't require lawyers. And I am one, and one of my children is one, so I say that with a heavy heart. I think everybody ought to have a lawyer, two or three, in a perfectly functioning economy. In this case, though, we've allowed the planning to be done over and over and over. And in my mind, and I've argued this again for years, the planning ought to be done once. Big conversations within a community. How should we look? Where should the density be? Where should the roads be? What kind of jobs should we have? What kind of lot size should we have? All the things that go into a town or a city. That should be a big conversation. Everybody in town should be involved in that. When it comes down to building permits, there should be no conversation. The implementation should be fast. It should be quick. It should be relatively cost-free. You should make sure you comply with the plan, and that should be the discussion. But in Oregon, what we do is we plan, and then when the development application comes in, we plan again, and then when the buildings are approved, we plan yet one more time. That's costly. It's inefficient. Madam Chairman, I would conclude, and hopefully take some questions if there are any, with a request. Please don't bog down. We've been here too many times, and we've gotten partway into the swamp and said, oh, the heck with it. This is important stuff. We are in an economic crisis in this state. Our land use system can help us get out of it. Building and development and creation of jobs can help us get out of it. Protecting rural Oregon and the agriculture base can help us get out of it. But we've got to get this work done. Please do that. We'll help any way we can. If there are work groups to be established, I'd like to volunteer Mr. Jillian's or every one of them. But we will help. We'll be at the table. If there are any questions, I'll be ready to answer them.
One or two questions so that we can have time for our next panel. Anybody want to take either of these gentlemen on? Representative Clem.
Just a comment. I am not necessarily disputing that there are changes that could be made in our regional differences, but there are a lot on the books of things that you do differently in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon. Minimum acreages, minimum income tests, tons of things. So I just need to really have an understanding of whether it's truly just a total political perception, which is a problem, if that's true. I mean, I grew up in Coos Bay. I frankly did not get land use nor understand why we had it. I was baffled the first time someone said, I can't believe that's a golf course on good farmland. I was like, so? I'm going to go golfing. Well, I don't get it. Now I understand that I live here, why we don't all just sprawl all the way out to the mountains. But I did not get that growing up in Southern Oregon. But I know there is regional allowances for different things, and I just got to figure out if it's truly just application fees that have to come down or what the problem is that people can't access it for me to feel good about going to another sort of alternative. And I'm more than happy to engage fully on the urban stuff.
Okay. Good. Representative Wingard?
Just because I think your answer might be interesting, John. As a thought experiment, let's go back to 1900 and pass Senate Bill 100. What do you think Oregon would look like right now, 109 years later?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, several wise acre comments come to mind, but I'll pass on them, including the fact that you might assume I was around in 1900. I don't think necessarily all that much would have changed, to tell you the truth. I remember a study we did some years back, or actually we didn't do it, 1,000 Friends did it, we were involved, that Farm Bureau was involved, and others, looking at, and Mr. Stacy and some of his staff are here, so I won't go into much detail, where they looked at whatever year it was going forward, 30 or 40, with extrapolations, modeling, with various assumptions being made. It didn't look a lot different based on regulatory. The population base of Oregon is still going to be in the Willamette Valley, no matter when you did the planning, because that's where the water was, that's where the easy shipment of goods was going to take place. It was not going to be out in Harney County, because Harney County in 1900 was still Harney County in terms of rainfall and distance. I'm not sure that we would. It's difficult to think about what might have been on the ground different versus what might have been different politically. And I'm not sure which direction you were thinking of going with your question, Representative. The on-the-ground development, I suspect we'd still be having the same arguments. If we started 70 years earlier, I'm not sure we'd have resolved them, at least based on our current process.
Follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
I guess my point was, assume the level of development in this state in 1900, and then start the Senate Bill 100 process, not from 1973, but from 1900. And now we're 109 years into it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that was basically, Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, the study that was being done, it was basically looking at sort of that assumption of, would the cities merge together? Would you have a different growth pattern? And it really is fairly, the differences were fairly marginal. You could see them once you were looking for them, but you had to get some pretty dramatic changes in terms of lot sizes, in terms of assumptions of how big an urban area grew, before you actually saw much in the way of distinction. One of the things, every state in this country has, every jurisdiction in this country has some form of land use controls, whether they're not necessarily like ours on the books, their sewer line expansion, their land price, their other things that keep cities relatively constrained, usually built based around infrastructure delivery. So if we started in 1900 and gone forward, Portland would probably be larger than it is today in terms of population. It might be somewhat larger in terms of its size. But assuming that you had the standard cost for water, sewer, power, et cetera, that was always going to be a limiting factor. The hills, the Chehalem Hills were always going to be there. The Coast Range was always going to be there. You're going to have some geographic constraints. I guess I'm not sure that, I think we'd recognize it. I think from a flyover we'd see the towns we had then, now, on a slightly larger basis.
One last question.
Quickly, because we have quite a few members waiting to testify.
If the answer you're giving me is that basically it wouldn't look very different, then I guess my last question to you is what's the point of having the laws that we've had for the last 39 years if it wouldn't look very different?
Madam Chair, for goodness sakes, look at the time. I understand you have a very busy agenda ahead of you. Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, that's an excellent question.
Thank you.
Probably one we will delve into over the next couple of weeks. Legitimate question. Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to bring forward Matt Donegan, Bruce Chapin, Jeff Stone, and Gary Conkling. And it looks like I've got three chairs possible. Can we figure this out? Thanks, Mr. Hoyt. Musical chairs, gentlemen.
Yeah, maybe Speaker.
Farm and
forest. Forests, farm, nurseries, and vineyards. Mr. Donegan, you want to get us started?
And thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Donegan. I'm co-president with Forest Capital Partners. For the second largest private forest landowner in the state, and I am very pleased and honored to provide this testimony. Just cutting straight to the chase, I wanted to deliver a few messages with regard to private forest lands, private working forests, with regard to land use. Number one is, I hope probably the major takeaway would be that economics matter. Number two would be that most economics are outside of Oregon's control or influence. Number three is that most of these economics have been generally very disadvantageous to Oregon's landowners, private landowners, since 1973. And I'll go into all these in a little bit more detail. And number four, there are some matters that are within Oregon's control, and I'll speak to that. And then number five, economics have shifted dramatically since 1973, and I think any land use system cannot remain static but has to be responsive to changing and evolving economics facing landowners. On the first point, economics matter. To illustrate this point, my company has taken actual transaction data and looked at what we call a hold value versus a sell value. So hold value meaning if you were to hold your forest forever and ever and look at a perpetual stream of sustainable timber harvest, discount all that back to the present, and then compare that with what you could obtain tomorrow by selling it out in the open market, fragmenting it up and selling it, on almost every acre that we own, we're overwhelmingly incentivized to sell. So there's really no distinction between a long-term owner and a short-term owner. If you're the longest-term owner out there and you're financially driven, you're going to sell tomorrow. In eastern Oregon, the ratio can be 3-1. Western Oregon, it's at least a 50% premium selling tomorrow versus holding forever and ever. So I'll be glad to answer any questions on that later, but generally speaking, I think if you look at this hold versus sell ratio, it really does describe landowner incentives, and you'll see why there's a lot of pressure to sell and fragment forest land, potentially convert it. Number two, what's driving this? As I said, economics are largely beyond Oregon's control. Two big themes, globalization, trade, and then the other one's just technological revolution that's taken place since 1973. By way of illustration, in 1973, there was no such thing as oriented strand board. The entire panel market in forest products was made up of plywood. Today, oriented strand board makes up, I think, 65% of the North American panel market. How many oriented strand board mills are located in Oregon? None. Never. They've all been located in low-cost areas. This has been a catastrophe for Oregon's forest products industry. Plywood's a staple of our industry here. We've seen plywood mills being shut down all across the state because they're getting outcompeted by cheaper oriented strand board mills. So this technological change that nobody would have expected in 1973 has absolutely devastated a key segment of the forest products sector here in Oregon. That's forced prices downward. The third message is that the economics of forest products and timber, like almost all commodities, have largely deteriorated over the last several decades. If you look at lumber prices since 1980, are down by 53%. Plywood prices are down by over 40%. Pole prices are down by 43%. And standing timber prices are down by 43%. Since 1993, standing timber prices in the state are down by 63%. And these are big numbers. They're very shocking. But if you look at since 1980, like corn and wheat prices are also down by 80% since 1973. So this is kind of a long-term trend in economic trend facing commodity growers. Number four, shaping policy that's within Oregon's control. You know, I would just say definitely focus on economics. Economics around timber production, encouraging timber production, economics encouraging non-timber production. And in the context of land use planning, concepts like transferable development rights that compensate landowners for not selling their land, not fragmenting their land. I think one of the concepts laid out in this in House Bill 2229 is equity. And I think complementing the regulatory system with more incentives speaks to equity. I think politically that will make any land use system more sustainable over the long term. And then lastly, what I'll leave you with is that, again, economics have shifted a lot since 1973. Land use planning has to be responsive to this. This is going to continue. It's not going away. And I think this review is appropriate. I think the principles laid out in 2229 are also appropriate. Thank you.
Mr. Chapin. Go ahead.
Chairman Nolan, members of the committee, I'm Bruce Chapin. I'm the third generation to farm in Mission Bottom area north of Kaiser. My son is the fourth generation, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Our operation focuses on raising filberts and cherries. What I would like to do is address the question of why does it matter to a farmer what happens to the neighboring lands around him? And to answer that question, there's three areas in which I'm affected. First being, which is often referred to as the critical mass issue or the infrastructure issue, as the surrounding land base decreases, then there is less market for the suppliers, and as such, then the suppliers tend to move elsewhere or not provide as much services to the remaining farmers. The same thing can be said for the canneries or processors in general. If there's not a good land base, then our markets go away. And that leaves the remaining farmers in a injured position and encourages them also to exit the industry, which creates a spiral and the industry is gone. Secondly, the reduction of farmland reduces the opportunity for farmer-to-farmer business interactions. These farmer-to-farmer dealings are very important to farmers in the total part of their total business. Give you a few examples here. First, the average U.S. farmer leases about 50% of his farmland he farms. As the neighboring lands decrease, his opportunity decreases. And without a leasable farmland, the average business would be literally cut in half. And clearly, the boundaries of the farmer's business extend well beyond the boundaries of their own operations. Farmers often lease and hire machinery from the other farmers. This causes an economical way to utilize machinery that otherwise a small farmer couldn't justify owning on his own. It also gives an opportunity for a person to invest into a specialized equipment and then help recoup the costs by going out and doing custom work for the neighbors. The same thing can be said about farm seed cleaners, mint stills, and crop dryers. As the land is removed, the agricultural potential for those farmer-to-farmer relationships decrease. I personally have a nut cleaner and dryer, which I clean and dry hazelnuts for about 25 other growers, in addition to my own hazelnuts. And I will lose one such grower this next year because the city of Kaiser has chosen to make a park out of his field. That's going to adversely affect me about $5,000 a year in my business, even though that orchard's 4 miles away. So just I want to give that as an example of just how these interactions exist. Let me give you another example of how my business has been affected by the conversion of farmland. Much of the money that I earned to go to college, I got from doing custom work with combining. One of the clients I had was had a bent grass field, which I combined for several years. That bent grass field today is was turned into a gravel pit, and now it's a mined-out gravel pit. It's a hole in the ground, and it'll never produce farmland, or never produce farm crops again. It's not going to produce any more gravel either. It's a hole in the ground, and there's few things less valuable than a hole in the ground. Another farmer-to-farmer relationship that is often overlooked is a farmer providing markets for other farmers. To help put into perspective the magnitude of these farmer-to-farmer sales, recognize that the Oregon forage industry is produced by farmers, sold to farmers, and the forage industry is as large as the wheat industry in the state of Oregon. So there's a huge amount of dollars changing hands between farmers. This is also true of the nursery industry. The nurseries produce a lot of trees for farmers, berry plants for farmers. I also have a Filbert nursery.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. In which I sell trees to local farmers. As the loss of the surrounding land occurs, my business will also be jeopardized. A third way in which the surrounding farmland is adversely affected by land use conversion is by the conflicts that are created. And often you hear about these. But I'll give you just a real recent example that I had here this last spring. It's actually kind of an ongoing thing. But it occurred when I was trying to spray a filbert orchard, and the neighbor, for entertainment I think, I had her grandchild come out and stand on the edge of the fence. So my options are I move to the other side of the field and just have to skip that side of the field until a later time. It's just a conflict there. And you've got to understand that for the agricultural industry to survive, we have to have access to land and to water. And these conflicts literally deprive us of those rights. And I can't emphasize how difficult it is to deal with some of these issues. You need to understand, though, that there are other competing uses for agricultural lands besides houses that are also problems. One of those is the aggregate industry. We have alluvial mining of aggregate in the Willamette Valley that's consuming about 200 to 400 acres a year. This compares to urban growth boundary expansions of about 1,000 acres a year. So this is a pretty big conflict here that's often overlooked. I've included with my testimony a brochure. I'm not going to jump into the aggregate issue now, but I just for you to study, look at, introduce it to you. Don Schoenberg and I spent 3 years on the governor's consensus group between 2003 and 2007, and we did not accomplish what we wanted to within the consensus group. The issue is still here before us, but we did learn a lot, and that led to the writing of this brochure, and I hope you'll take a time to study it. One final thought as I close here, and that is that the farm industry can last forever, but the individual farmers cannot. We all die like everybody else. And because of that, the ownership of land has to keep changing. Right now, the USDA predicts in the next 10 years, 50% of the farmland in the U.S. is going to change ownership. Whether that ownership transfers to farmers or to non-farmers will play a big role in the future of agriculture of this nation. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
I'm going to have the panel finish, okay. And then we'll open all of you up for questions. Mr. Stone?
Madam Chair, Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. We are your largest sector of agriculture with the sales of over $1 billion a year, 81% of which gets shipped outside of the state of Oregon. I think we're uniquely situated to talk about this issue because the members I represent are both urban and rural. And so we have a perspective on land use because we are a traded sector. We're a natural cluster. And hopefully a voice of reason on an issue that can devolve into emotion or also become a painfully academic exercise that doesn't seem to serve anybody's purpose. You have my testimony before you, and I will not read that to you, but I would submit to you that not all farmland is sacred. I mean, that's something different than perhaps my Farm Bureau brethren would say, but there's a report that I have attached for you. It's not green as Mr. Jillian's. I did print it out for you. But it does look at agriculture in a different way about its productivity and what lands are essential for the economic and foundational survival of agriculture. So it looks at it really in an economic sense. So I would submit to you to take a look at this report that was conducted by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. We also believe that we must, through this process, embrace a new view of how we look at urbanization and look at what's really under threat of development and what is not. And our biggest nursery counties are Marion, Clackamas, Washington, Yamhill, and Multnomah. People forget that we have a lot of nurseries in Multnomah County. But I would say to you that we must get away from the guise of an economic argument because the debate shifts on what industry you want. So you're really talking about replacing one industry with another. So I would, as you have a recommendation from the Big Look Committee, and there are things that we can support in there, but I'm also a former chief of staff to the Metro Council and have been on the other side about presiding over large expansions of the urban growth boundary. So I can see both sides, and it becomes a numbers game. And we need to get away from that. So I would ask you to listen to my friends in the real estate and construction side, the environmental community, and agriculture, because it's not simple. Unless you, if it was, you would not be having this much time addressing it. So we will stand, I'll be concise and end now, and offer our help in helping you get there. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You. And colleagues, I want to apologize because of my management of time. Mr. Conkling, who I had invited to testify on behalf of the Vineyards, had given me notice, and I lost track of the time, so he had to get to another appointment. He has submitted very concise, useful testimony. I had particularly wanted that perspective to be before us because that part of the agricultural use agricultural natural resource use of the land use system almost didn't exist in 1973. And yet now today it represents an industry that brings about $1 billion worth of economic activity to the state. And to put that in context of the changing circumstances, I think Representative Wingert has referenced that indirectly. A segment of our economy that we knew nothing about, hadn't planned for in the original land use system, and yet has been able to deliver that kind of economic activity. So I'd encourage you to read that. He's not available to answer questions, but these fine gentlemen are. So do we have any questions for this panel? You've really hit it on the head. The only question I would have, Mr. Stone, you've already offered to help and be available. Mr. Donegan, I think some of your information we still need to absorb, but as we approach this issue, the economic viability of some of the forest lands is something we'll want to follow up on, and I hope we'll have access to you if we need it. going forward.
Yeah, I should have mentioned, Chair Nolan, that I submitted written testimony as well that I think lays out my verbal testimony in a little bit more cogent fashion, so hopefully that'll be helpful, but if there's any follow-up, I'd be more than happy.
Great.
To.
And Mr. Chapin, thank you for your testimony as well. Thanks. Okay. Mr. Honeycutt, Mr. Stacy.
Whose laptop is this? State of Oregon.
Oh.
You have slides for us?
I do not.
Okay. Did you guys arm wrestle over who gets to go first?
I said, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon, in action. I came up to, sat next to Bob and said, who's going to go first? I really don't give a darn. And Bob says, you can go first, so if it's okay with
Honeycutt,
you,
please.
I'll go first.
Yep.
Didn't say darn, Madam Chair.
Since we're on the record, we'll say what it is.
I'm shocked.
You'll notice in my testimony, the testimony, the date of the letter is May 24th, 2006, and the testimony is addressed to the Oregon Task Force on Land Use Planning. I didn't make a mistake. I just thought, as I went through that testimony, that this was this is what I presented in the very first meeting of the task force, where, as a matter of fact, I was sitting next to Bob, where we were invited down to testify, and I think it's just as relevant today as it was back then, and so I hope the committee will find it useful. We, as you know, at Oregonians in Action, our mission is to defend the rights of private property owners. I've spent a fair amount of time down here over the last few years doing that. I started in the 97 session and have been here ever since, and so it's an interesting job and an interesting state that does interesting things as far as land use planning goes. And we also were the prime movers behind Measure 37, Measure 56, Measure 39, and helped out significantly on Measure 7, and then opposed unsuccessfully Measure 49. Back in the last election cycle. There are a number of changes that we believe very strongly need to be made to Oregon's land use planning system. Some of those encapsulated in the Big Look Task Force. And as we go through those, I hope that the committee will be mindful, and I'm sure you are already if you haven't, if you've been in here at all over the last couple of weeks, that this is a very divisive issue. It has been in the years that I've been in the building, and I suspect that it will continue to do so. One of the things that we think is very important is that we expand the role of local governments, give the local governments more authority to make calls. That's especially important in rural areas. Representative Clem talked about one size fits all, whether that's a myth or not, and the example I think that best encapsulates that issue is the definition of agricultural land in LCDC's Goal 3. It's actually not a one-size-fits-all definition. It's a two-size-fits-all. Agricultural land in Goal 3 is defined there's two definitions, one for the Willamette Valley and one for everywhere else. And so in the Willamette Valley, agricultural land is considered to be Class 1 through 4 soils and other soils in Classes 5 through 8 that are necessary for the continued production agricultural production. So what we have, and then in eastern Oregon and everywhere else, it's 1 through 6 soils. And so the idea that somebody that doesn't think that they have a non-resource or thinks that they have a non-resource piece of property can go down and get that zone non-resource, it doesn't happen. If their property is 1 through 6, outside of the valley is 1 through 6 soils. And so the problem that we have, I grew up in Columbia County, my dad grew up in Klamath County. The same definition of agricultural land applies in Columbia County and Klamath County, and yet the climate, the economy of Columbia County, which is Timber County, and Klamath County, which is used to be a potato growing county anyway, is vastly different. And you can't
that's two size fits all, but it's still a significant problem. It's the same in the inside the valley. You've got land on the valley floor in Marion County, and then you have the Stafford Triangle, which is zoned for agricultural use, but there ain't much agricultural use going on in the Stafford Triangle, whereas in the area around St. Paul and Marion County, there's a significant amount of agricultural activity going on. And so we think that the best decision makers on that are local governments. I know there are some county commissioners who don't want to get involved in that fight, but you know, my response to that is, well, if you don't want to get involved in tough decision making, you shouldn't have run for office in the first place. That's part of the job, and you know, it is what it is, and you can go in eyes wide open. Resolving the farm and forest land issue is that is the crux. That's the fight. It always has been the fight, and it always will be the fight. We have questions on infrastructure, how we finance infrastructure. Those questions, particularly in an economy like this, are difficult. I don't know that there is an answer to them, but it all revolves around money. Resolving the farm and forest land debate not only revolves around the economy, but it also revolves around worldviews and that whole conflict between private property rights and the rights of the community. It's a problem. It will continue to be a problem until we resolve. And the problem that we have, that our organization has philosophically with the statewide planning system, is the definition of ag land in Goal 3 and forest land in Goal 4 are so broad that we've zoned 97% of the privately owned rural land as farm or forest land. It's 97%. We could talk about farmland, and this gets to Representative Greenlick's point the other day when we talked about the polling on private property rights versus the land use planning system, and what are really private property rights, and the same issue is what is land use, you know, what is land use planning. We can have these polls, we can ask these broad questions. What you'll find is that people want private property rights, undefined, they want land use planning, undefined, and they want everything, and they don't want to recognize the differences between anything. And I don't blame people. Unless you're one of an insider, you don't get the conflict and how it works. But the point is,
and they want it for free.
Yeah, well, absolutely, absolutely. But the point is, until we can figure out how to resolve this farm and forest land issue, and until it's been my experience that since 1997 that there's been virtually universal recognition that there's land outside of urban growth boundaries in farm and forest zones that isn't farm and forest land. Until we can resolve that, this problem will go on. And it's like Groundhog's Day. I'll be back here in 11 and 13 and 15 and whatever. And Bob will be retired by then, so I'll outlast him. saying the same thing. And so, I hope that you can solve that. One last thing, and then I'll shut up. Measure 49... if you think back and you were around last session on Measure 49, they created Measure 49 creates a private or a ombudsperson, and the DLCD, within the DLCD staff, and the DLCD has hired an ombudsperson, and I'm really glad that they finally did that, because up until that point I was the ombudsperson. I get lots of calls every day from Measure 49 claimants saying, how come my claim hasn't been resolved? I'm in the express lane. It's not express. What's going on? Here's my problem. Help me fix it. So on and so forth. There are a number of issues with Measure 49 that I think the bill needs a little bit of tweaking in order to make it work. And I'm hopeful that either this committee or whatever, whether it's this committee or another House committee, wherever the Measure 49 bill goes, I'm hopeful that we can get that done so that the people that were promised the quick, you know, the relief under Measure 49 can actually see that. It's an elderly segment of the population. These are generally people who have owned their property since prior to 1973, many of whom will not, if we can't get their claims resolved, will not live to see the day that their that their claim is resolved and the promise that was made to them during the campaign actually comes to bear. So with that,
we'll have a bill that we hope will receive your favorable consideration on Measure 49, and we can make just a couple of modest changes to the measure.
Thank you. Mr. Stacey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Garrett, the members of the committee. I'm Bob Stacey, 1000 Friends of Oregon, Executive Director. Thanks for having me here today. I want to depart from the comments that I turned in to join in what Mr. Honeycutt just said about Measure 49 implementation. You know, the people of Oregon voted overwhelmingly to support Measure 49. A key component of that message was that Oregonians would receive rapid, express, expeditious review of claims made. And Mr. Whitman's agency has a big job. There are a lot of facets to that job. But one consequence of the cuts that the Ways and Means Committee will be considering is that the governor's proposed includes reduction in the resources applied to Measure 49 in the department. We're very concerned about that. I'd like to see the ideas that Dave talks about for fixes in Measure 49. As you can appreciate, the two of us don't always agree on whether we're talking about fix like the veterinarian does or fixes that solve the problem. But that aside, I share the concern that Measure 49 work, and we need to make it work, and I hope to have an opportunity to visit with you again about that. I also want to explain, if not apologize, for the stack of material that's been directed to you in conjunction with my testimony. There are some remarks that I want to summarize today. There's the most recent written testimony that we provided to the Big Look Task Force. I didn't go all the way back to our comments in May or our comments in March of this year or our comments again in the summer. But there are also some exhibits, and I just wanted to bring your attention to them. I know you don't have time to read everything I give you, and I apologize for imposing. But 3 years ago now, in 2006, we began our own public outreach process to ensure that we did our best to highlight to Oregonians that there is a big review of land use planning that's about to get underway. We called it Envision Oregon. And over 2 years, we held 18 workshops around Oregon. We engaged face-to-face 2,000 Oregonians around tables at workshops who talked about what they wanted to see for Oregon's future and what they most valued about the state today. In the second round, we tried out different ideas about reforms to land use planning, including regionalism and land use fairness, among others. Not to supplant the work of the task force, but to inform it. We supplied the task force with the raw data from each of the 18 meetings. We supplied the task force with copies of this report. And ultimately, in January of last year, with a copy of our Blueprint for Oregon's Future, our own proposals for improvement of Oregon land use planning. When I looked at the testimony that I'd written yesterday, again this morning, I have to confess that I thought there were some there were some pointed remarks in here about the recommendations of the task force and about some of the task force's actions. I want to make clear that 1,000 Friends of Oregon supported, both in 2003 when it wasn't successful and again in 2005, the legislation that created the task force. We worked to provide information to the task force, including our Envision Oregon series. And I know most of the members of the task force and knew them before their service. And the members of the task force are honorable, smart, hardworking, and they're sincere in their recommendations. I also believe that they failed to accomplish a couple of the key assignments given to them by the Legislative Assembly to conduct research and inquiry about the performance of the land use planning program so far in a systematic way that would enable good comparison and good analysis, and that they failed to engage the public in the discussion about options, alternatives, and the future until they had completed their own analysis and reached conclusions about changes that ought to be made. And I think those departures from what Senate Bill 80 laid out did affect their conclusions and probably the quality of their work. While they didn't conduct research about the performance of the land use planning program, the Institute for Natural Resources, OSU, did, and that work was submitted to the task force this summer, and that information is contained in the task force's report. And I think the task force's report is important reading for all Oregonians. I want to cite just a couple of conclusions that the task force report has from the research of the Institute for Natural Resources researchers. Two broad conclusions. This land use planning system that we have in Oregon has done a better job of protecting and maintaining the land base for agriculture and forestry than that of any other state in America, and that the urban growth management system has produced benefits and saved costs in ways that have not been equaled by any other state. In other words, we have the most effective and successful system of land use regulation in America. When you read that conclusion, including a little factoid like the residents of the Portland metropolitan area, the Tri-County region, annually, in comparison to other large metropolitan areas in America, save a total of $2.5 billion in transportation costs and save travel time because of the compact urban form, you recognize that the ideas that were launched by the 1973 legislature, by Governor Tom McCall, by Senator Hector McPherson, have led to two generations of policymakers at the state level, at the local level, doing hard work that has yielded benefits for Oregonians. And I don't think we should lose track of that fundamental finding and conclusion. And we should not, in the haste to look at the specific recommendations of the task force, as the doctors say, you know, first do no harm to those accomplishments. The task force report and its recommendations contain some very useful prescriptions for improvement of the Oregon land use planning system, and I want to address those. But they also have a catalog of what I think of as recurring complaints where no new light has been shed on what those complaints are about. One is assertions about the complexity of the Oregon planning system. Don't get me wrong. I know how thick the statute book is. There's way too much detail in the statutes. They've been changed many times by past legislative assemblies in response to specific requests for itemized changes. Thus, Representative Clem has already spoken to this. There are 51 non-farm uses listed in the so-called exclusive farm use zoning statutes. It's no longer an exclusive farm use zone. It's a hodgepodge zone that also attempts to protect farming. And therefore, we support the concept that the task force laid out of doing an assessment of the statutes and the regulations to see whether there's some form of streamlining and clarification that can occur while perhaps actually strengthening the ability of LCDC to work moving forward. But we should not lose track of the fact that particularly in comparison to our neighbors to the north and south, but in comparison to other communities across the country, Oregon's land use approval system is faster and simpler than our peers, or as I like to think of them, our competitors. If a business is looking at whether to locate in a community in Oregon or a community in California or Washington, that business knows that here, once they've obtained what developers call their land use entitlements, the planning and zoning approvals, they're not required to file a state-level environmental impact statement, as they are under state legislation in California. They're not required to go through an entire new set of hoops on the way to getting land use approvals because we don't have that kind of pervasive environmental review case by case. We attempt to resolve those issues in the comprehensive plan. They also don't have a local government that's required to act within 120 days on their application once it's made complete. And they don't have in either Oregon, or Washington, excuse me, or California, a system in which there is an appellate review body, the Land Use Board of Appeals, which only does land use hearings and has its own time limits to ensure that it acts promptly. They go into Superior Court or the local trial court in those states, and they have to battle to get on the docket with all the more pressing matters, at least to the judges, that clog those dockets, and they deal with a judge with general jurisdiction rather than special expertise. Those changes, those differences from other states, aren't apparent to us because we work in Oregon, and we want an ideal system. Let's work for the ideal, but let's not lose track of the fact that the system we put in place is faster and more straightforward than the competition. Another old chestnut that we see in the task force report and which has led to some recommendations of the task force, is this idea that there is one set of regulations and that one size fits all, and that there's no differentiation between different parts of the state. And without nitpicking Mr. Honeycutt on the definition of agricultural land and how it's applied, let me point to some of those. There is no statewide minimum lot size, even though there's an 80-acre default minimum lot size for agricultural land in those two thick statutes. In fact, state-approved, locally adopted minimum lot sizes on agricultural land in Oregon range from 20 acres to 320 acres, based upon local characteristics, the kinds of agriculture that are practiced, the characteristics of commercial farming for those crops and those landforms. So, you know, which is the one size that fits all? I have other examples in my testimony about development standards inside urban growth boundaries that vary dramatically from community to community. The task force also points to what it calls perceptions, and you've heard this discussed several times already today, about unproductive lands that have been misdesignated for farming or forestry. And the task force argues for a highly complicated new process to go back over land designations and to undertake new studies and try to come up with new definitions, new mapping processes at considerable expense at both the state and local level. Let me simply remind the committee that according to LCDC's own data, since 1989, counties following existing law have redesignated at least 20,000 acres of agricultural land to other rural categories. It is possible. It is done. It may be expensive on a case-by-case, applicant-driven process, but there's nothing preventing counties from undertaking it as a legislative matter and trying to identify specific areas in which several properties are misdesignated. There is a process in place. We should ask the question very carefully, what's broken? Why does it need this fix? Let me very briefly, because you want to end this hearing at some point, go over some of the points that I think merit the committee's careful consideration for legislation. First, incentivizing regional planning. I'll defer to Representative Greenlick about the success or failure of the idea of annexation law change as one of the incentives, but the premise that we should pay more attention to the regions, particularly the growing regions of our state, and provide mechanisms that ensure that regional problems can be addressed effectively should be taken up by the committee. One of the small tragedies of last session was that Springfield was granted essentially an annulment of a 35-year-old working relationship with Lane County in Eugene because of a breakdown in the existing system of regional coordination. It ought to be addressed. Springfield isn't isolated. Springfield is part of a metropolitan area. And every one of our larger communities in Oregon ought to have more tools for working together, not fewer. Capacity for planning. So many of the problems that the task force has heard about, particularly these concerns about misdesignated lands, have a root in the fact that compared to other western states, according to the task force, Oregon counties spend less on planning. We have underfunded this planning function at the local level, and I think you could persuade Mr. Whitman to say it's been underfunded at the state level as well. This is not a time to start building planning empires with public dollars. But it is a time to ask serious questions about how we expect to accomplish better planning in our communities, clearer rulemaking, clearing out the thickets, unless we are willing to put some resources into that and ensure that that work can be done. So we're wholeheartedly behind the task force's recommendation that additional capacity be provided at the state level and at the county and city level. Public involvement. We're concerned that the task force waited until it had completed its recommendations before taking them to the public, as opposed to engaging the public at the front end. But the task force at least identified for the rest of us the fact that planning needs the people. In fact, planning has always been at its best in Oregon and in Oregon's communities when the public was actively engaged in it, when it wasn't left to public interest groups, special interests, to the bureaucrats, but engaged the community. When planning and zoning becomes a series of referee decisions between applicants and opponents, and loses track of the vision of a community and the dialogue with the community about where it should go in the future, it's not going to be relevant for very long. We need to do what Arnold Kogan reported to you the original Land Conservation and Development Commission did in 1974. They had hearings all over Oregon on the statewide planning goals. They engaged 10,000 people face-to-face. They had a mailing list of 100,000 in a state that barely had 2 million people. And as Mr. Kogan suggested, that level of engagement meant that there were conversations all over Oregon about land use planning that carried over into the planning process at the county and city level over the next few years, and which allowed people to make informed decisions when they were asked in 1976 and 1978 to repeal the land use planning laws, and they rejected those proposals. Finally, we very strongly support the strategic planning recommendations of the task force. Oregon faces big issues, bigger issues than the miszoning of a few thousand acres of land in rural areas. It may not be more important to those specific landowners, but we know that the pressures Oregon will face as, by the official projection, we grow by 1.6 million between now and 2040, and by the unofficial estimate of many experts, it'll be more like 2 million, and it'll probably be earlier than 2040 when those 2 million people arrive. We need to be prepared for that kind of development and make sure that the result strengthens our communities and leaves us the state that we love in a recognizable shape. We know that climate change is here and beginning to affect us. We don't know what the consequences will be. We know there will be consequences regardless of our efforts to mitigate our contribution to it. But land use planning will play a very important role both in mitigation and in adapting our communities and our landscapes to the impact of drought and flood and other consequences. And finally, what we've gone through since October of this year, when the financial collapse in the United States led to a worldwide economic decline. We know that the interconnected global economy leaves our state and our communities at great peril. It's a source of potential strength, but we need the resilience to deal with the threats of a global economy, and that kind of resilience can be built into our communities and our state if we have a forward-looking plan. We need a strategic plan. We have no plan yet for getting one. That should be a primary focus of the work you do in this committee in response to the Big Look Task Force. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thanks, Finland. Questions of this panel? Representative Klein?
I don't know that it needs to apply just to these potentially miszoned acres, but how do you both feel about transfer of development rights or purchase of development rights as a path forward for someone who we at least admit they have rights and then we're willing to purchase them or trade for something where we want to direct growth generally?
Madam Chair, Representative Clam, transfer development rights is an interesting concept. It's been around for years. The problem has always been making sure that the supply meets the demand. And so the real cause for failure of a TDR program is that you have 100 property owners holding up these transferable development rights certificates, and you've got one property owner that wants one, and so there's your supply and demand never meet. So I like the concept and certainly think it's a good way to sort of balance the benefit and the harm caused by the regulation, but it's going to take a significant amount of work to make sure that you try and match those up as best you can.
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, 1,000 Friends of Oregon has been encouraging the use of transferable development credit programs at least since the 2005 session when we offered it as a proposed alternative to compensation or waiver under Measure 37, a way to provide landowners financial relief rather than waiving land use regulations by requiring purchase of those rights by people who sought development in locations where the development would be permitted. Dave is correct. Making a market for buying those credits is an important hurdle to overcome. And we've had suggestions about looking at future expansions of urban growth boundaries as logical locations for what the technical experts call the receiving area. If I have a Measure 49 development right and I would just as soon sell it as build on it, and someone in a proposed urban growth boundary area that becomes part of the urban boundary has to acquire rights before building, then we have a market. That's one possible application of the concept.
Okay. Anybody else?
Madam Chair, it's just I...
Representative Greenwood?
So many questions are raised by several of these panels that it really feels to me like it would be wonderful if we would have some time for some conversation around these. And I know we have a difficult schedule to meet, but it would be...
We will have time for some conversation, both specific to House Bill 2229, the overall issues, some dialogue among the committee members, as well as looking at some specific amendments. Before we do that, certainly I think everyone we heard from today and in the last couple of informational hearings will be paying attention to what we do on that bill, as well as a bill to address some of the issues in implementation of Measure 49 and possibly a bill relating to the 51 exemptions in the EFU zone area. So we'll have plenty of time for dialogue. We will, colleagues, have a public hearing on Tuesday, which will be for public testimony on House Bill 2229, and we will probably have at least one other in addition to that. Have we managed to set an evening meeting yet?
There was a couple of conflicts, so it's not...
Okay, so we haven't quite set the time, but I would like you to help us have an evening hearing on that bill so that people who can't be here during their workday can weigh in on it, because we do want to have real live folks. I highlighted the comment you had in here, Mr. Honeycutt, about making sure that the committee would be served well by seeking counsel and advice from those not involved in the battle over the last 33 years. And that's exactly what we're going to start doing next Tuesday afternoon.
Yes, I'm glad I could help.
Okay. Before you leave, I have one question from Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify. So on Tuesday of this week, we talked about 2 weeks from Tuesday having the evening meeting. Is that now canceled?
All right. Tuesday next week, we will meet at 3 o'clock in this room for public testimony, general public testimony on House Bill 2229. Ms. Ross is still trying to find a time when the committee, at least a significant majority of us, can meet in the evening to also have general public testimony. But we will meet next Tuesday at 3 o'clock for public testimony.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I may not have been clear. I think we spoke of an evening meeting on Tuesday the 3rd specifically, and I'm wondering if we need to...
We were talking about the 10th as the evening meeting.
Okay.
And that's the one that we don't have a critical mass on.
So we are not going to do it on that date? We rearranged the calendar for that date, and I'm trying to figure out if we need to go back.
I did too.
Well, we have, as I understand it, we have two members who can't make it that night.
I might be able to make it. It's just a little complicated.
We may want to just proceed with it anyway. I don't know that we will ever get absolute quorum. It's 100%
we'll take it off the
Representative Hanna, I think you were...
Yeah, if you see the farm bureau thing. Yeah.
Let's conclude this hearing, and then we'll sort that out.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. We will let you know. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm sure we'll see you again.
Yeah.
We're going to close this informational meeting.
I realize that I'm a member and I can't not go.
Or my
they should have declared.